Now, this is weird. I have done some freaky shit.
Hey, boys, I have a headache.
That makes absolutely no goddamn sense whatsoever.
Movies in the Buff.
Hello, and welcome to Movies in the Buff, where we strip down, objectify, and violate your favorite movies. Here are your hosts, the team of debauchery. We have Carl.
Let me tell you about the time that I almost got eaten by James Gandolfini's porn stash. Well, rather, let me don't. I'm just going to forget that that ever happened.
The porn stash and the lovely Lisa.
Thank you. You're a white man.
Oh, and I'm Rod. And tonight we'll be buffing Fallen. Assigned to nab a killer before he or she strikes again, tough homicide detective John Hobbs, played by Denzel Washington, knows he's on a dangerous assignment. Duh. And one for which he's uniquely suited. But there's more to it than he realizes. Turns out he's not just up against a killer. Yeah, he's just up against a killer. He must face an evil spirit that can morph from one innocent bystander to the next. Directed by Gregory
Hoblit.
Okay, and also starring Donald Sutherland, John Goodman, and James Gandolfini, and Imbeth Davids.
And James Gandolfini's mustache.
And James Gandolfini's porn stash. The rat that they taped to his face. We'll start this episode off with buffing at 6 degrees. This is where I give you an actor from our current movie and an actor from the movie we buffed last week. And a member of our audience must connect them in 6 movies or less. Send your answers to inthebufffilms@gmail.com. The first person to answer correctly will receive on-air recognition. This week we're going to be connecting Linda Boyd and Michael J. Pagan.
We have to correct something.
What's that?
Didn't we have somebody buff a movie from a couple weeks ago?
Did we?
Yes, our guest star.
Right. Unfortunately, he actually posted from the episode we were recording before the episode posted.
But we still haven't given him recognition for it.
We haven't given him recognition. So James Bartholomew did get the 6 degrees from the So I Married an Axe Murderer episode. So, good call. Good call. And also, I actually could not find that post anywhere. I remember him posting it, but I've not been able to find it since.
Huh.
I'm wondering if maybe he deleted it, or...
He might have deleted it because he realized that he posted it before the episode was out.
I think he did. But that's okay. Thank you, James, for answering. And I'm hoping to get James back on the show soon, so we'll see.
Oh, yeah, we're gonna bend over backwards to get him and the rest of the guys over there at Initiative Check on here. I know Rob's chomping at the bit.
Yeah.
We just have to get a movie picked out for him.
We will try to rush. I've been really, really busy lately, and I apologize for that, listeners. But we will try to rush to get that done. Hopefully, probably not next week, but hopefully the week after. So we'll see how that works out. Do we want to move on to a roundtable? Okay. I think my tongue.
Spit it out. It don't belong to you, Rod.
Yeah. Anyways, roundtable Fallen.
Yeah, the roundtable covered with imported beer.
Yeah, exactly. I did not expect the Denzel southern drawl. It seemed like it disappeared throughout the movie, but at the very beginning it was really thick.
This is at the time when Denzel's career was really taking off and he was changing as an actor. And are you not familiar with his earlier stuff?
I'm trying to think of what he did earlier. This movie was in 1998.
He actually had quite a bit earlier stuff. If I remember correctly, Philadelphia was earlier than this.
License to Kill. Oh, that was a TV movie, not the.
Yeah. Let me see. He's been acting since '74.
The Pelican Brief. That was all before this.
Philadelphia was right before that, and so was Crimson Tide.
And The Preacher's Wife was before that, so he was pretty established before this movie.
He was, and all of that stuff, he is very Southern, and especially Crimson Tide.
Fair enough. Now that I think about it, you see all of his movies prior to Fallen and all of his movies after, and it really is like his career just did a flip.
Yeah, he did a lot of...
It really got weird after that.
Yeah, he played... I mean, he... he changed as an actor.
Yeah.
About the only thing that, you know, where he dips back down into that native Southern accent. Mm-hmm. Not native Southern. He was born in New York.
Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah.
I knew his accent was faked, but it's really, really good.
But yeah, that good old boy thing, and he stopped doing it after pretty much in the middle of this one, and then he didn't use it again until Remember the Titans. But it's that,
and even in Remember the Titans, it really wasn't that thick. Mm-hmm. Not like it was at the beginning of this movie.
Yeah.
It could be just that his agent told him that he needed to have the accent.
Yeah. And it works for him. I mean, his voice is, you know, you can just kick back and close your eyes and just listen to him talk, so.
But anyway, you get the scene outside with Donald Sutherland, the mummy pimp. And
oh, poor Donald. 1-star reviews from Donald Sutherland.
Oh, no, I hope not. I love Donald. I've loved Donald Sutherland since MASH, and I wasn't even born when that came out, but I love the movie.
And, God, it's weird. You know, this is a movie that I watch every year.
Mm-hmm.
I try to. This and American President, I try to watch once a year.
Mm-hmm.
And this year was the first time that it really struck me how much Kiefer is starting to look like his father.
Oh, my God, I know. It's really strange. Well, yeah. And since that show Touch came out, you really notice it because he is trying to look older in that. Like, I say older, trying to look his age. He's not trying to look younger than what he is.
Yeah, and I was never I wasn't a big 24 fan. Like, that's one of the shows I still need to go back and watch.
Yeah.
So I haven't really, you know, seen him since he was a kid.
Mm-hmm. But he is. But, you know, I even liked Donald Sutherland and Joss Whedon's abortion known as Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie. So,
yeah.
Actually, no, I take that back. It was a good movie for what it was. It was supposed to be campy. It was good. And I can't wait to review it. I'm pretty sure it's on streaming. But
you're going to put me through that. Would you just die already?
Wait, I just have one thing to say to that, to the whole us reviewing Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Would you just die already?
I knew that was coming. I knew it.
Oh, yep.
Okay.
Anyway, back to Fallen. So okay, we're now, out in front of the...
What I want to know, once he gets into the jail, are we calling him Casey Lecter or Hannibal Jones?
Oh, man. Reese is freaky, am I wrong?
He is. He is. Well, Hazel is freaky, like all the different...
I have one thing to say to the both of you.
Mm-hmm.
You both call me nuts.
Mm-hmm.
You can stop now. I am not that nuts.
Good point.
I have not started speaking in tongues as much as he does.
He wasn't speaking in tongues. He was speaking Syrian Aramaic.
And German.
Was he speaking German?
Mm-hmm. At the very end, he was speaking either German or Dutch.
I had the subtitles on. It just kept saying Syrian Aramaic.
Yeah, and oh man, we had a problem with our subtitles.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't know if it was just us or our connection or what it was, but it would show the subtitle as they were saying the line, and then it would flash back and display the subtitle of the previous line until they said another line.
That must have been your connection. I didn't have that problem.
Yeah.
But,
Well, here's another instance of him being completely nuts. If I'm going to the execution chair, I'm not going to be dancing instead of walking.
I love the grandstanding.
And that's not a thing of it not being Edgar Reese. That's a thing of it being Azazel, because Azazel is not going to die and he doesn't give a crap.
Yeah. But I really love the way that I love the way that this guy played a possessed man. I really did. And apparently it's not the only time he's played one. I can't name specific.
My actual first note says dead man walking or dancing, strutting.
Yeah. One of the things in the trivia on this movie is that these scenes with Reese were some of the earliest scenes that they shot.
Mm-hmm.
And the director loved the way that, you know, because the guy who plays Reese is such a physical actor.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved all that physicality and all those little quirks in movement. And so every other person that had to play be possessed by Azazel would actually watch Reese's performance and then try to mimic it to the extent that they could in order to keep that physicality and those, you know, gestures and movements when they were playing possessed.
I'm actually, oh.
So it actually worked. That's why you see that, you know, you get that sense of, continuity between the different people that Azazel is possessing.
Yeah, but even, like, each different time he possessed, it was like he took a little bit of the aspect of that person or, you know, took the innermost workings of that person and brought them out. I don't know, but each different, you know, incarnation of Azazel, I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought that was really well done. I'm looking for the actor that played Reese, and I can't find it.
It's right there on the front. Elias Koteas.
Oh, there he is. Okay.
Koteas.
I just kept looking over him. Elias Koteas.
Denver
Mine, awesome movie.
Yeah, Shutter Island, Shooter, and Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
He also played an episode of House, if you remember right. He shot House.
Oh, yeah, that is him, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
He shot House in the neck.
Yeah, I didn't remember.
All
I didn't
stuff that I
it.
Haven't seen.
You saw House get shot.
You saw this episode where he got shot. I'm sure you did, because I think you watched it with me.
Yeah.
But still.
I stepped out of the room during the shooting, and y'all didn't rewind it, so don't blame me.
Okay. But then, you know, the demon, the floaty demon, ooh. And
yeah, but how did you love the photography of, you know, when Azazel is in spirit form?
I'm trying. In 1998, given the current level of technology they had,
mm-hmm.
I'm really trying to explain how they did some of that photography. The only thing I can think is everything makes sense up until it goes through the wall. And the only thing I can think is they green screen the wall.
Mm-hmm. What they actually did, where is it? Because I saw this on the trivia when I was looking last night. The way that they shot that is, where is it? Oh, yeah, the demon vision footage of the film was shot using a film stock called Ektachrome, which is developed for stills mm-hmm. photography, and the scenes were all shot at 6 frames per second and printed at 24 frames per second, meaning each frame is exposed 4 times. Coupled with camera movements, this technique gives that blurred, streaky quality. And they also used a mesmerizer lens, which allows the camera operator to cock the lens, you know, to the right or left several degrees.
Who so that's is how you got director all of photography stuff. Here?
I don't know.
I gotta find out, because okay. This man is a genius.
Yeah, everything in here is beautifully shot. Except for the one scene later on that Lisa complained about in the church where they shot upside down. And that's just her personal quirk.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But anyways, but yeah, you got the floaty demon and you got what I call, and this happens several times throughout the movie, you got what I call hide and go possess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. Newton Thomas Siegel.
Newton Thomas Siegel. You are a genius, sir, and I tip my hat to you.
Yeah. Known for Usual Suspects and X-Men 1 and 2 and Drive.
Okay, he is a genius.
He is a genius.
Some of my favorite photography in any movie ever. Apparently he did them.
Yep.
So, and Lisa, just for the record, I do occasionally wear a hat. Usually it's rubber.
Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to touch that one.
God, I hope not.
And that's what she said.
Yeah, I'm not touching it either.
See, I told you that's what she said.
Well, that's because, well, anyway. Okay. Then we have, speaking of not going to touch that, we have the porn stash.
Yeah. Hello, Jonesy and Porn Stash Lou. Yeah.
James
Gamble. Okay, that brings
ever wear this again. What?
That brings me to an interesting question.
Mm.
In that conversation, they're discussing no cream. Uh-huh. What in the bloody hell is that?
They're talking about him taking kickbacks.
Okay.
Or doing underhanded things. You know, work,
like taking bribes.
Bribes or kickbacks, work on the side, things like that.
Okay, did any of y'all ever watch The Sopranos?
No.
Okay, well, do any of y'all ever know the ongoing joke about the way The Sopranos ended?
Uh-uh.
Okay, at the very end of the show, you know, a lot of people were into it. The very end of the show, the very last episode, cuts to black in mid-sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And it, there was an uproar about it. Do you know why that happened?
Mm-mm.
Because the power of the ugliness of this porn stash went forward into Gandolfini's career and stopped his show when it was just getting good.
I'm not even sure that that is a porn stash. I think it's a weasel that they found and just stapled his upper lip.
Or a ferret.
Yeah.
But all I'm thinking in the scene around the table, you know, they have the bud joke and the important. And all of this would be funny if it wasn't for the fact that I'm sitting here thinking he's smoking a cigarette with this mustache going on. You're going to light the damn thing on fire, man.
Uh-huh.
I am terrified about this. I'm sitting here. Every time he goes to take a puff on his cigarette, I'm thinking, oh, my God, please don't, please don't, please don't. Oh, okay, he's okay.
I give James Gandolfini props for being able to play, you know, a really sleazy dick cop.
Yeah.
Through that weasel on his upper lip.
Yeah, he's an amazing actor. I just wish he would never. I mean, that was an aesthetic choice by the costume director that really never needed to be made.
Yeah. He doesn't have enough hair on his head to put that much hair on his face.
Now, just out of curiosity, what time period are they trying to portray in this? Because it seemed a little older than 98.
It was
setting here.
I think it was kind of left open, but it was, you know, near present. So it would be like, you know, mid 90s.
Yeah. Now, granted, this was like pre CSI and open knowledge base about forensic investigation and things like that. So
right.
A lot of their investigative techniques would have made sense in 98. Mm-hmm. But it still just seemed like it was a little older than that.
Yeah.
But then you have Hyde and Go Possess again.
Yeah, I refer to that as Traveling Evil, round one.
I couldn't decide to call it Hyde and Go Possess or the Possession Shuffle.
Yeah. Although they are really cool themes, though.
They are awesome. And later on, I call it what was it? Never mind. I'll just say it when I get to it on my notes.
Reach out and touch someone. Yes.
There you go. I reach out and touch something. Anyway.
Yeah. So then we've got Azazel in Charlie. Nobody knows that yet.
Yeah, the possession scene though has a lot of like before they were B-list actors.
I was looking at this and I know you and I were talking last night while you were watching the movie. Uh-huh. And you were talking about how a lot of the set or a lot of the scenes are shot in the police station.
Uh-huh.
And I got to looking, and it turns out that the police station that they're using uh-huh. is the set from NYPD Blue. And a lot of the
that's why it seemed familiar to me.
What are they called?
Cops, the extras.
The extras. A lot of the extras are actually actors from NYPD Blue.
Nice.
Yeah. But and you know it never says what city that this is filmed in, but all of the exterior shots and everything around it, even the cabin at the woods, is all in and around Philadelphia.
He does say Philadelphia at some point.
Mm-mm. No, they never actually in the movie say where it's filmed, but where it takes place. But it is in Philadelphia that they did all the shooting and everything.
Yeah, I knew that it was Philadelphia from just looking at it, but it seems like I could have sworn.
Mm-mm.
Anyway. Oh, and just for the record, John Goodman can play a lot of things, and he's an amazing actor. Mm-hmm. He doesn't make a very good cop.
You know what's funny?
Hmm.
The role of Jonesy was specifically written for him.
Really?
Nicholas Kazin specifically wrote Jonesy for John Goodman.
See, that seemed like almost his worst role he's ever done. And maybe it's because I did too, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it was a bad role. I'm saying it's the worst he's done. The man is an actor. He's an amazing actor.
Yeah. But this is before a lot of his big movie stuff.
This is
a lot of his, you know, this is some of his earliest post-Roseanne work.
If I'm not mistaken, this is during Roseanne.
That could be.
I'm looking it up now.
Roseanne, 1988. I don't know how long it ran, though.
I'm looking.
Quite a few years, because she started out with her oldest being Becky as a preteen, and she went off to college during the mm-hmm. Roseanne.
No, this is post-Roseanne. 1988 to 97.
Yeah, 1 year post-Roseanne.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is, you know, he was writing it for that John Goodman. You know, the John Goodman who was the dad in Roseanne. So.
Yeah.
But I love him in this. Jonesy is one of my favorite characters. But now then we get to meet Sam and Art for the first time. Huh. And, you know, it never specifically says what is wrong with Art, but yeah. I get the feeling that he's slightly retarded. But did any of you guys get any
the
other
way they talked? Mm-hmm. Now they never specifically said this, like you said, but the way they talked, he had some sort of an injury, like a car accident or something like that, mm-hmm. that caused some brain damage.
That could be too, because I know that they
there was something wrong with his brain. Is all I can catch.
Yeah, and you know they talk about how he ended up coming to live with his brother, or he and Sam ended up living with his brother, and John's wife ended up leaving him
because of it. Yeah,
or sort of. You're led to believe that it might have been because of it, but
yeah. But anyway, and then I don't know what this means. Sometimes I take notes and I don't know what they mean.
Well, I've got the first body.
Yeah.
Yeah, my first body note says OCD much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because then we've got what's there. It's a clue, Magoo.
And then you have just when you thought it was safe to go to a crime scene, it's the return of the porn stash.
Yeah. Yeah. But then we find out that, you know, we've got a new body that, and we find the riddle that Reese told Hobbs from the prison cell written on the wall behind a picture.
Uh-huh.
You know, why is there a space between Lyons and Spakowski? Uh-huh. So right away we know something's going weird.
Yeah. Now, there was a line said in this part, mm-hmm. in this scene, that really struck me. It was like, whoa, wait a minute. Where he says, they're questioning motive. And he said, well, what? We don't have motive. And he says, everything's motive.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Crazy is motive. Money is motive.
Yeah, everything's motive. And that's, you know, I don't know how much Holmes you read.
Mm-hmm.
From early days when I was reading Sherlock Holmes, he would always say, motive means an opportunity,
mm-hmm.
which became a pretty much like a mantra of investigation, of modern
yep.
investigation. And that's something that was really interesting. When you think everything is motive, it really changes the meaning of that line.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because it's true. I mean, anything can be motive. You just have to figure out what the motive is.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and then now we start really digging in on this riddle of, you know, why is there a space between Lyons and Spakowski? And we find out that, you know, the space is on a Cop of the Year award plaque, and we find out about Robert Milano, or start to.
Uh-huh.
The scandal.
And the scandal.
Did anybody catch the web browser, or the web surf engine that he was using?
Oh, yeah, he was using web
was
crawler.
Was that Google?
Crawler. No, it was web crawler, which was anytime pre-Google that you see a movie where they're searching on the internet, you'll see them use web crawler.
Web crawler was a search engine I used back when I used dial-up.
Mm-hmm.
So, if that tells you anything.
But it pretty much, you know.
It tells me that their searching on the web lasted about 2 hours.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first hour and a half was to get on the web.
Yeah.
But he starts questioning the meanings behind everything, and then you have Donald Sutherland's next scene. Did anybody else feel like Sutherland's scenes were kind of pushed?
Kind of, but it was, you know, he's not necessary. He's playing the, you know, John's captain or lieutenant, but he's not just speaking for himself. He's also speaking for, you know, the quote unquote powers that be in the police force.
Yeah.
The egos upstairs, as he calls them.
But that's exactly. Not even what I mean. It seems like this was a character they needed in order to create the twist at the end.
Kind of.
Spoiler alert.
But they also, you know, needed somebody who was telling John, you know, to leave the Robert Milano angle alone.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when things start going south for John, then, you know, he's got that sort semi-friendly ear.
Yeah. I just love it that he looks at him and says, I can't help. And the only thing I can think at this moment is, you know, you're really in trouble if you're in a movie and the Sutherland can't help.
Yeah. That's true.
That's when you're screwed.
But then we get to go meet Greta for the first time.
Yeah. I didn't think that I would, when I saw this girl in this movie, I did not think I was going to like the character, because nothing have I ever seen her in that I actually particularly liked her character. And I
just was she in?
Matilda. She was also.
Oh yeah, that's right. She was the teacher in Matilda.
And she was also the young girl in Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
But my problem.
She was in Bicentennial Man and Schindler's List.
See,
I don't remember her from
neither
Schindler's
one
List.
Of those. Neither one of those have I ever actually finished.
Hmm.
But anyway, my problem is every character she plays, and I guess I don't know if it's the characters or if it's just she did particularly well in this one and typically tends to suck, but it seems like, I don't know, seems like she should not be acting. You know what I mean? Like, that was not her calling.
Yeah, but this was definitely...
She did amazing in this.
This was definitely a stand-up role for her. I mean, this was great. I actually kind of liked her in Matilda as much as I liked anything else in that movie.
See, the movie was meant to be overacted, and it felt like she was holding back. And I guess that was the character and the way that it was written, but I just didn't like the way it was done.
The problem with Matilda is that it's a Roald Dahl story.
Yeah, that's true.
And those are really, really hard to translate onto film.
Yeah. But I actually read the book when I was much younger.
Yeah.
But
you're not that old now, Rod.
No, I mean like 15 years ago.
Yeah, like little.
Like little.
Matilda's a children's book.
Yeah.
Which is why it feels the way it does when it's translated to film.
Oh, and now, you know, the dead cop's daughter teaches theology. How convenient.
Mm-hmm.
But,
it was funny because, that character of Greta Milano was actually originally supposed to be two different people.
Really?
It was supposed to be Greta and then another older woman who knew more about the fallen than Greta did.
Mm, okay.
And that cabin out in the woods was actually supposed to be that older lady's home. And then they ended up changing it and they combined the characters.
Okay.
But
another thing you can really tell about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when it starts getting into the demonology and things like that and the story of the fallen, you can really, it kind of dates this movie in a sense that it was prior to the quote unquote New Age revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where people started learning about, these different mythos behind demons and, you know, witchcraft, druidism. You know, people actually started learning these things and movies and TV shows, for example, Supernatural, it's the only thing I can think of offhand. They had to become much more accurate to these mythos.
Mm-hmm.
Where in this, they could pretty much throw anything in there and it was believable. You know
what
I mean?
I can't believe Supernatural is the only thing you can think of when you're a fan of things like Buffy and Angel.
Buffy and Angel took a lot of liberties. There were a few things there, but they took a lot of liberties.
Yeah.
And even then...
Here's a movie for you. The Craft.
The Craft was very accurate. It was anything.
Yeah, it was the beginning.
Definitely the beginning. And you have Buffy was started in what, 96?
Yeah, they started paying more attention the farther in they went.
Yeah, the end of the like 5th, 6th, and 7th seasons. Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. Angel was a lot closer related. Surprisingly enough, Charmed, not necessarily their actual, you know, actions and things like that, but a lot of their symbolism and things like written symbols, things like that, that was actually very accurate.
Yeah, although they took liberties where they needed to in order
to make a story.
Not just to make a story, but where they needed to not, you know, butt heads with any particular belief system too.
Mm-hmm.
Like they kind of opened things up so that they weren't, you know, locked into any particular belief system or structure.
That makes sense. But anyway, we could be on a theological discussion of this sort for the rest of the night. So
yeah, let's
let's move
that.
On back to the movie.
So we meet Greta, and then, you know, we end up with Charlie, or with Azazel popping out of Charlie.
Yeah.
And, you know, Charlie ends up becoming the second victim.
Yeah, which was a little weird. You know, the guy had no idea what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't he the guy who calls his boss's wife and asks, "Was I supposed to work tonight?"
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Charlie.
That's Charlie. And
who actually Charlie isn't his real name, but as we find out later, but that's how we know him here. And so we find out that not only, you know, does Azazel you know, possess people, but that they have no knowledge of the of what they do while they're possessed.
Yeah. This was also just before this scene. Denzel had a voiceover. I don't remember what he said, but this was the point where the voiceover started kind of growing on me.
Oh, that was the one where he's talking about, you never know, the guy that you pass on the street and he looks at you, does he know you? And
yeah, and that's when Azazel looks at him.
Yeah, because that's when, yeah, Azazel passes him on the street.
But,
right before he jumps out of Charlie.
And at this point, what's funny is that having to transfer by touch, the image that popped into my head after watching this demon change hands quite a few times was the scene in The Stand where Randall Flagg holds his hand out and goes, "Pleased to meet you. Hope you guessed my name."
Mm-hmm.
That was what actually popped into my head. And then, of course, this is when I started realizing the whole Rolling Stones theme behind it at this point.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think almost everything in this movie was a Stone song.
Just about. It was the demonic fat guy kill. That was really kind of a weird kill. I mean, it was like...
Oh, where he busts through the chain door and stabs him?
Yeah, but the way he held his arms and everything, it was... I wasn't sure if he was actually realizing he was jumping on a person or if it was just another fat guy diving after a sandwich. But did it not look awkward to y'all? Especially considering you got this like 400-pound guy and this like 90-pound guy.
I don't know. It didn't necessarily look awkward to me, although I did really like the way that it was that kind of stop motion film technique that they used in that scene.
No, it wasn't the filming. It was the blocking that was really awkward to me.
Oh, it doesn't bother me. So,
fair enough. Then they get back to the police station and you start finding out that the demon's left-handed. That's how you can tell.
Yeah. And we find out that
Reese was originally not left-handed.
Right. And we find out that he's speaking in Syrian Aramaic.
Yeah.
Which at the time that this movie came out, that was, you know, that was kind of a big deal. It was one of those things that, you know, the Syrian Aramaic hadn't become a trope at this point.
Yeah.
Like, this was one of those times where you really didn't know it. That it was, or you didn't know, most people didn't know that it was the language of the Bible was, or the biblical times.
What's really weird is not a year after this, Stigmata came out.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you've never seen, is one of the most wild biblical based horror movies I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily scary, but just kind of wild, you know? But,
that depends on how often you watch scary movies.
Oh.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, apparently I was mistaken. Out of generally. The six songs that are on the soundtrack, of the six songs that are on the, or that are in the movie, only two of them are performed by the Rolling Stones. But the others you never even notice. They're just
background, you
know, background noise.
Yeah. But the two that they definitely bring attention to is Time Is On My Side and Sympathy for the Devil there for the credits.
Yeah.
And those are both Stones.
But, and then they find another riddle. And at this point I'm thinking, oh my God, he's possessed by Edward Nygma.
Yeah, you does realize.
Anybody get that?
Yes.
Okay. No.
Lisa,
Edward Nygma is the name of the Riddler.
From Batman.
Ah, that explains it. I don't watch much Batman.
He generally went by his first initial and his last name.
Which is Enigma. Which means mystery.
Yeah.
But, no, that was, and, you know, it looks like a riddle, but it's really not. It's actually Azazel communicating with John, telling him that he is just like Robert Milano.
Okay, yeah. I did not see what was on the wall in the second Vic's apartment or house or whatever.
Well,
read it.
Yeah, I'll tie this together for you and explain it. Okay, in the first one, you see Lyons, ? And then Spakowski, right?
Yeah, and we figured that was from the dead cop.
Right, that's the, you know, why is there a space between Lyons and Spakowski? And in the second one, it's the mirror hanging on the wall, and behind the mirror, he writes, ? ? Equals look in the mirror. meaning that the ... is the space between Lyons and Spikowski, which is Milano. And Milano is the same as him him looking at Milano is the same as him looking in the mirror.
Okay.
Oh.
Because he's saying you're just... Because remember, he started all this off by saying, you remind me of somebody, Hobbs. When he was in Reese in prison.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He goes, you remind me of somebody, Hobbs. Yes, you do. Let me ask you something. Why is there a space between Lyons and Spikowski? So, you know, we've got the whole, you know, Azazel trying to communicate with John there. And then, you know, John looks over at Jonesy and tells him, you know, about seeing the guy, the body in the tub, you know, had walked by him the last night and looked at him like he knew him, which, you know, really adds to his kind of freak factor there.
Was that? Okay. Sorry, I was trying to figure out the looks that they were giving each other in the evidence locker, Porn Stash and Hobbs.
Oh, yeah.
I was trying to interpret that. I couldn't. They were really weird looks for two people who were supposed to be friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they're the way I get it, or the impression that I get from their interactions, is that Lou's kind of new. Like, he just transferred in recently.
It said when they were in the bar, you just transferred in 6 months ago.
See, yeah. This movie suffers from Denzel syndrome. The problem is you cast Denzel in a role and suddenly, for some reason, decide that no other characters in the movie need backstory.
Yeah. Well, they get some backstory. It's just,
some, but not nearly enough.
Not enough.
Yeah, and I'd forgotten that they even say about Lou transferring in recently. That was just always the impression I got. So they're not real tight friends yet. They are just kind of in that getting to know each other phase.
Fair enough.
Still. And, but no, we're still in Charlie's apartment, and then later on we cut to, I think we go straight from that to them playing basketball, don't we?
Yeah, the basketball game.
Or no, we go from that to him down in the basement.
Yeah, that's the looks thing I was talking
about. Yeah, the whole looks thing, and then they cut to him playing basketball, and which I thought was kind of fun.
That was an interesting scene. Now, I get the humanizing effect that this scene had prior to, you know, Jonesy's interruption. But, and I get the necessity of it, but I almost would have once again rather this scene be filled with a little bit more backstory on the supporting characters.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, having a humanizing scene. But, you know, it's a choice by the director and by the writer. And so it's not necessarily a bad choice. It's just a choice that I didn't agree with.
Yeah. But then, you know, Jonesy interrupts the basketball game and, you know, fills in Denzel on Charlie's story. And we find out that Charlie was actually the killer of the first guy.
Yeah.
So, and then we've got Jonesy's great line there. But,
now how did this, okay. I missed some stuff with, what was the cop's name?
Jonesy?
No,
John?
The one that dealt with him before John.
Oh, Milano?
Milano, yeah. What exactly happened there? Because I know Milano took him out to the cabin. Took the demon out to the cabin. Well,
the story that we get about Milano is that he captured a killer, and then copycat killing started happening. Evidence was started showing up at the crime scenes that made it look like Milano was doing the copycat killings. And so Milano went out to the cabin and died, quote unquote, cleaning his gun, which is, you know, as we all know, police speak for, you know, a cop who killed himself.
Yeah.
What's inferred is that Milano was attempting to kill Azazel and failed.
Hmm.
It failed so badly that Azazel didn't even realize that that's what was actually happening. But, that may not have been what actually happened. What may have actually happened is he, you know, knew what he was up against, but couldn't do anything about it. So he committed suicide rather than letting Azazel continue to screw with him and mess up his career and his family.
Yeah.
So.
Fair enough.
But no, we find out that, you know, the first killer is the second victim. And, So then John goes out to check out Milano's cabin and see if he can get some more answers. And
that's when he gets the name.
That's when he finds the name and he finds the books.
Yeah. Oh, look, on the wall. It's Azazel. Mm-hmm. And what does Azazel mean?
Yeah, that just seemed too convenient for me, though.
That wasn't... Well, it wasn't actually real convenient. I kind of liked the way that the Milano, you know, left the breadcrumb there.
Yeah. What I'm trying to figure out is how and why.
How he left it there? Or?
Yeah.
Well, what he did was he wrote the name on the wall and then painted over it and then took a photo of it and, you know, scratched the photo with a key to, you know, mimic, you know, scratching off the paint and stuck that in the books. And that was what he saw because he finds that picture in one of the books.
Okay. I was missing how he had come about that.
Yeah, he found
that. Yeah, I saw him holding up a photograph, but I couldn't tell.
Yeah, I couldn't quite figure out what was going on there.
Yeah, it was a photograph of that wall, and it had the word "look" printed up, or written on the back of it. And so that's why he went back there and, you know, wiped the paint off with the paint thinner and found the word Azazel written underneath of it.
Got it. Okay, that makes a whole lot more sense now.
That would explain why it seemed a little convenient for me.
And once again, it's another scene that just felt a little rushed. And honestly, this movie was over 2 hours long. So the fact that they had to rush scenes to get the information in...
Yeah, it just means that there's a lot of information.
Wow. Yeah, that's an insane amount of information for one movie.
Actually, you're right. It's 4 minutes more than 2 hours.
Yeah.
But, no, so we get, you know, he checks out the cabin. He's found the books and Azazel's name. And now he's got to go back to Greta and try and figure out what it all means. And she's not going to tell him.
Of course not. Because, you know,
walk away,
that would just be too easy.
Yeah.
I do like John Goodman's. I guess I just kind of skipped over the Greta scene because it really didn't mean much other than she's not going to tell him. But
yeah.
I do like John Goodman's. I need a translation of the translation.
Yeah, because we finally get a translation of the Aramaic that Reese was speaking.
Yeah.
Which I just dearly love.
Yeah, I did
see that speech. Even though Goodman doesn't read all of it because we hear other parts of it later on.
Mm-hmm.
When Denzel's watching the video again, he's got the translation in front of him. And there's parts of it in there that John Goodman didn't even read. And what's interesting about that is when they were, Nicholas Kazin was writing the movie, or he's on, when he was writing the movie, he actually went to a guy, I don't remember where, who actually did speak Syrian Aramaic to help him with the dialogue. But the guy was, too religious, so he wouldn't read the curse line, the lines where he curses.
Oh, yeah.
So they actually had to get a different translator to write the Syrian Aramaic for those lines.
Well, you know what's a general...
Hence comes the joke. I need a translator for the translation.
Nice.
Yep.
Nice. Well, you know what the actual protocol on that is when you're writing something in a language other than English or whatever the first language is of the movie? You write it in that particular language. In America, generally, that's English. And then they bring a translator in to do it.
Right.
And,
but yeah, this guy actually went
really
to
wild.
A,
of course, I guess in 98.
Write it.
I guess in 98, once again, it just would not have been an easy thing to find a native Syrian Aramaic speaker that also spoke English.
Right.
Not 1998 anyway.
Well, still now it's hard to find because it's actually spoken natively by, you know, a couple of nomadic Bedouin tribes.
Yeah.
And I'm not even entirely sure that they still speak it. But, no, then we go, you know, we go through that hole where he's getting stalked.
Yeah, oh shit, it's a possessed porn stash.
No. This is where he's getting stalked in the night and he's chasing the guy up to the, train station or the subway station. But,
it's a monorail.
Yeah. Then we go back up and Azazel gets into the police station and into Lou, and it's time to freak out Hobbs.
Yeah. That was wild.
Oh God, that was
some of the best mental warfare ever.
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite of the whole, you know, traveling evil scenes.
Yeah.
And essentially, and again, I'm, you know, talking about trivial stuff from this movie, but the way this movie actually came about is the writer was thinking about the concept of, you know, how how bad your evil actions can travel from person to person. Like if I do something mean to you and that causes you to do something mean to somebody else.
I didn't really think about that.
So yeah. He was wondering what that would be like to see it, you know, to see it live or to see it personified. Mm-hmm. And so he came up with this scene right here that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And built the rest of the movie around it. So this scene is the actual genesis of this movie.
And wow, that's pretty actually impressive.
Yeah, and okay. I think that's why it's one of the best scenes in the movie.
And with them bouncing back and forth between the people like that, mm-hmm. to do the stalking, the only thing that I could think of, like while the demon's getting away from Hobbs,
mm-hmm.
only thing I can think of is that old ball in the cup game. Where he's sitting there, find the demon, find the innocent, find the innocent, find the demon, find the... That's all I could think
of. Yeah, like three-card money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, anyway. Then I got a, hey, I think he's figuring it out.
And now we go back to Greta and start getting some friggin' answers.
Oh, before that, you've got the spectacled porn stash.
Spectacled porn stash?
Yeah, where he's actually wearing the really wild glasses, and I actually...
Oh, the reading glasses, yeah, because...
I had to write down at this point, I think they're just buying props from a joke shop. I think this is to see how many joke props they can get James Gandolfini to wear before he says, hey, wait a minute.
That includes the mustache, right?
That includes the mustache.
But, and those awful workout sweats from earlier.
Oh, God. His whole character, and I respect him so much as an actor, but his character throughout this whole movie made me facepalm constantly.
Yeah, he's there essentially as kind of sleazy comic relief.
Yeah,
and to give jokes to somebody other than John Goodman.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
and then you got look, he's trying to get inside Hobbs, just like every black woman in America.
There might even be a few white women who are trying to get inside.
Oh, I'm sure there's more than one or two.
Oh yeah, but no. So now we're at the wherever it is. It's some outdoor like gazebo type deal, and talking to Greta, yeah. And trying to and finally getting some answers out of her, and convincing Hobbs that he's not going completely nuts because that's how he feels at this point.
Mm-hmm. Jeez.
And then
Azazel calls Greta Chippy?
Chippy.
Yeah, the Chippy.
Yeah. Yeah, he calls her Hobbs' little Chippy, which is, they use it because it's an old, it's an dated slang term. Mm. And so they're trying to once again portray Azazel's age. And, so that's why they use that particular term, because that one hasn't been used since what? 50s, I think. Maybe.
That sounds about right.
But
40s or 50s, something like that.
But basically a chippy is, you know, like the Girl Friday, you the girl who's hanging around you.
Yeah. And then he tries to possess her.
Yeah, we got Azazel on her trail.
Which was a really good escape. I'll give her that.
I was lucky.
I love the chain possessions in that scene.
Yeah.
Trying to get to her. Mm-hmm. But what I want to know about this whole scene is, why did it take the taxi driver so long to go? You got somebody attacking your car, man.
Yeah. Yeah, they did kind of draw that one out.
Yeah,
just
that...
bit,
yeah.
But then, you know, he wasn't expecting it, so you might have a second or two of freak out from him.
Maybe, but the second the guy hit the glass and
hit
smashed
the window.
It. Yeah, that's when it's
most
time to
go. Most cab drivers would have taken off at that point.
I either take off or pull the baseball bat out from under the passenger seat. You know, I'm not sure which one he would have done, but just sitting there wasn't an option.
Depending on where
you're at. Yeah. By the way, just to get this off my chest, I actually referred to this whole scene with the chain possessions and everything as the chase scene from hell.
Oh, my God.
Which is terrible, I know.
No, I liked it.
Yeah.
That's a good one. You know, I just now realized something. I'm pretty sure this is the most tropeless movie we've ever done.
Kinda, yeah.
There's not a lot of tropes, and there's not a lot of reoccurring themes. Like, I mean, throughout the movie, yes, but not something you see very often, even for a possession-based movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely
its own league. Movies. Have some young girl
yeah.
screaming profanities.
or something to that extent. But there's not. I mean, this is all original right here.
It pretty much is. The closest thing you get to a trope is, you know, the comic relief sidekick cop,
yeah,
of John Goodman and
the asshole lieutenant.
Well, and he's not even really an asshole. I mean, he's
that's true.
He's good friends with Jones and Jonesy both, and you know he's got people coming breathing down his neck that you know he's trying to keep off of them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I love the line. You don't really want to know, Lieutenant.
Yeah,
I don't really want to know.
Yeah, I was there, and I don't really want to know.
Yeah,
but that's when you know you find out that he's starting to become a suspect, just like Milano.
Yeah, and it doesn't the possessed kid thing.
Yeah, and then Azazel starts coming after the family.
Yeah, that was
it's into Sam.
He messed up.
Yeah.
What really was interesting to me is why not the brother? Thinking something to do with his mental.
I think it does.
State kept him from being possessed.
I'm not sure if it was that or if it was just that you know Azazel knew that being in Sam would give him the maximum fun and B, maximum freak out for John.
I guess.
And, but then we've got, you know, the teacher committing suicide by cop.
Yeah. I wrote it down as gunfight with a demon. Really?
Yeah, come on.
But that's when we find out the very important thing that, you know, or when John finds out the very important thing that when he moves his spirit, no man can resist him.
Uh-huh.
And which turns out to be really important. But Denzel also finds out that killing the host doesn't necessarily kill Azazel.
Yeah. What's weird though is, okay, no man can resist him.
You should have learned with Reese.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how he ended up possessing John's, or like that was really confusing to me.
What, the no man can resist him?
Yeah.
Greta spells it out essentially when he's talking to her again.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that people that he can't get into by touch, mm-hmm, he can still get into when he's moving as spirit.
Oh, okay.
Because he's fighting for his life, so he's fighting that much stronger to get into somebody.
Yeah.
Because we also find out later that once their host dies, they can only survive outside the body for one breath. Or about a sixth of a mile.
Okay. Yeah, it was
500 cubits.
500 cubits was what it was, yeah.
Yeah, which basically essentially is a sixth of a mile.
Yeah.
Cubits like what, 18 inches?
What I want to know is what are they really going to charge him with? It was this whole scene was kind of messed up to me because you've got two other witnesses other than the chick that got possessed by the demon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's claiming that Hobbs shot first, but
But at the time, she even all the witnesses were saying that, you know, it was a clean shoot.
Exactly. So, I mean,
but the problem
it was
is,
just like it, what, Greedo, a day later?
Well, the problem is that, you know, the guy had no reason to commit suicide by cop, which this obviously was. The gun he was firing was loaded with blanks, and he got the gun from a stolen car or out of somebody else's car. So nothing in this shoot or nothing in this incident makes any sense. And like Donald Sutherland says, people want the world to make sense, and if the only way to make it make sense for them is to arrest John, then that's what they're going to do. Because nothing about this event makes sense.
Fair enough. Then you got where, once again, I love Jonesy. I love the way he could break down the most complicated situation.
Like, what's the meaning of life?
Yeah, into the most simple stuff. And, from where I sit, we're dealing with shit that ain't in the manual.
Mm-hmm. No joke.
Or, I love the Hobbs line after that. That was the killer. We're going to arrange things later.
Yep.
It's just, but the way Jonesy breaks down everything, and this is just a John Goodman staple almost.
Yeah.
You know, he can either overcomplicate or oversimplify anything.
Mm-hmm.
As an actor. But I love how after the whole scene in the police station, you know, the whole depressing late night scene, all of a sudden it switches to Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. The next morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, John's wandering around, you know, finds the busted window in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Where somebody broke in. And, finds the Y on Sam's chest. And
do you know how much pressure it takes to bust a window?
He didn't actually break the window. He popped the lock off the top of it. They used like a Slim Jim type deal.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, you just slide something up into the window and hit it with a hammer, and it'll pop the lock. It'll pop the latch off of an old window like that.
Fair enough.
But, I'm glad most of our windows nowadays aren't that old.
Yeah. Think about what you just said, Lisa.
Yeah.
Most of our windows nowadays aren't that old.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I realize it sounds weird, but most people will get what
I mean. Okay, so then you find out that Azazel killed the brother.
Mm-hmm.
And,
which, that's still really...
Yeah, that was a hard-hitting scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was a very emotional scene, and nobody can pull that off quite like Denzel does.
Like I said, I've been watching this movie, at least once a year for over a decade now, and that scene still messed with me tonight, or last night. So.
Yeah, it does. And, but you remember what you said earlier about it being the chase scene from hell?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my next note was that's one hell of a frame job.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, because then you got Jonesy calling him to tell him that Lou's coming to pick him up.
Yeah, I have run. The porn stash is coming. But I do like the escape from the house, though.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good
out the window. Yeah.
Yeah, just the way it was.
We're gonna go play a trick on someone.
Yeah.
The way he handled the kid was really well done.
It was. And then, they get off the train station, and he sees the cops, so he turns around goes to buy a pack of smokes, but it's too late. The cops seen him and ends up having to deck the cop and take off.
That was a nice punch.
Yeah, and head for Undercity.
Yeah. And did anybody else get freaked out about how calm this kid was?
Yeah,
Seem older than what he was.
Yeah, this kid is really calm, though. I mean, every scene that he's in, he's really together. And I think that comes from, growing up with his dad being the way that he is.
Yeah, that's kind of what I caught, too.
Because, John is his uncle, John, is, a homicide detective. So you know that he's, gone late nights so a lot.
Uh-huh.
And so it's Sam and Art most of the time, and somebody's got to be holding things together, and I think that that's kind of fallen on Sam a little bit.
That makes
Sam calmer and more together than what he would be.
This cop gets on his radio and says, call all units in the area.
Mm-hmm.
How do they know what area he's in?
Mm-hmm.
It's pre-GPS. He's on a shoulder-based radio, which is running through some kind of a transponder. But,
well, yeah, it runs through those handheld mics that they've got. But also, he's on a beat. He's assigned to that.
Oh, that's true.
He's assigned to that train station. So
yeah, that's true.
Anyway, so then we're holding up for a minute in homeless territory.
Yeah.
Or I like to call it Undercity.
Though it didn't take long for him to decide to go to Greta's.
No, but I think he wanted to wait for dark.
Yeah.
So that people wouldn't be looking for him as much and he have a better chance to get there.
Yeah.
And then, John's got to tell Sam about his, dad being actually being dead.
Yeah. Which Sam had already guessed.
Yeah. An interesting note about that scene.
Uh-huh.
The audio that they originally took for that, while they were taking it to the production studio, the courier lost it in a cab.
Really?
Yeah, and they put out notices and rewards and stuff, but it never turned up. So what they ended up having to use was the actual audio tape footage that they took on scene on a Hi-8. And they sent that to the production studio, and the production studio was able to pull reproduce the audio well enough for it to be usable. But that's why the audio there seems kind of weird.
That is weird.
It's barely noticeable. I knew that going into this watching, and I still couldn't tell.
I kind of caught something different about the audio in the scene, but I thought maybe they just couldn't pick up the kid well enough, so they had to dub it.
No. Actually, it's entirely not dubbed. Because they couldn't reshoot. They were in a position where they couldn't recapture the audio.
Like,
they couldn't do a dubbing of it, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Then
we go to Greta's.
Yeah.
Start working on a plan.
Yeah, and I don't know that I like this plan. This plan felt wrong to me. This plan, and I'll tell you why this plan felt wrong to me, because it's already been done. It didn't work.
That's his suspicion.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, Milano tried this and it didn't work. But what I'm at, because Azazel didn't know what the deal was with Milano, I'm more entitled to believe that's actually a mistake on John's part, and that, you know, Milano actually did commit suicide.
Maybe, but.
I'm thinking he saw what he was up against and couldn't find a way to fight it. And so he just, you know, removed the temptation for Azazel to keep messing with him and his family by killing himself.
Well, that kind of makes sense. But then, you
know. Always have to have the sacrificial hero.
Yeah.
And then we've out at the cabin.
Well, we've got, before he goes out to the cabin, we got to plant the breadcrumbs in the cop's ears.
Yeah.
So we talked to Jonesy, who's, you know,
do got me a favor.
Lieutenant and Mr. Pornstash on the extension with him, trying to find out where he's at.
Do me a favor. Never ever reference breadcrumbs again in any scene that might have Pornstash involved.
Why are you afraid James Gandolfini might reach up and realize that there was a breadcrumb in there?
No, I'm just afraid his Pornstash might reach up and choke me. The Pornstash was the most terrifying thing of this whole movie. I am actually afraid of the Pornstash. Do you realize things like that? They go for the jugular.
In his case, they almost were at the jugular.
I've seen
I'm sure his wife is of the opinion that they go for the femoral artery.
I don't know how he could reach it over the Pornstash.
Oh!
He's got to have a really long tongue, man.
Oh. Wow, that is so...
So not going to touch that one.
That's getting turned into a ringtone, just so you know, Lisa.
Yeah.
Damn. I got to quit saying shit like that.
No, you got to keep saying shit like that. But, okay, so...
So we get out to the cabin.
Donald Sutherland coming out while he's at the cabin, you know, and Donald Sutherland's the first person to show up, and you're supposed to be led to believe that this is a demon, but I knew that the demon was not possessing him, and do you know why I knew that? Because mummies are already dead.
There's also another giveaway in this movie, in this scene, and do you know what it is?
What's that?
Donald Sutherland is holding his gun in his right hand.
You know, I caught that.
I would not have noticed that except until Carl pointed that out just now.
I caught that, and because of my memory situation where I can't distinguish right from left in my memory, I didn't want to say anything just in case I was wrong.
No. He is holding his gun in his right hand. What's interesting about the way that they played this is you've got Donald Sutherland, and he is holding his gun in his right hand, which you may not, you know, the normal audience wouldn't notice the first time through this. I don't think I noticed it the first time I watched this. But, and the other thing is, when Jonesy steps out, the whole time that Jonesy is holding his gun on Hobbs, he's holding it with both hands. And then, you know, you get to the big reveal of which one's the demon when Jonesy extends his left hand and fires.
And I really like John Goodman as a demon.
Yeah, John Goodman.
He made a really good demon.
He was almost as good as Edgar Reese, if not better.
And just so that people know, anybody who's listening to this right now, spoilers happen in a review. So
yeah.
I don't want to get a whole lot of, I'm sorry, but I just don't want to get a whole lot of emails saying, you know, you spoiled the movie for me. I was going to watch it after listening. Watch the movies before you listen to us.
Yeah, because we will spoil stuff.
We will spoil every movie you watch.
Yep.
And I just wanted to say that. That's because this guarantee. One had a really good twist ending that we're going to ruin if somebody's listening to us now before seen the movie.
If you haven't watched the movie, turn us off, go watch the movie, then come back and finish. And listen to it.
Well, and we've already spoiled it.
Yeah, we've already spoiled it, so.
We probably should.
No, we technically haven't.
Oh, that's true. If you've gotten this far, but haven't seen the movie, stop now and go watch it, because it's even twistier than this from here on out.
Yeah, it really is. But then you got some of the best John Goodman lines in this movie, and it's up against some pretty stiff competition. But while he's possessed, he has some awesome lines.
Yeah, I bet you weren't, you monkey fan fuck.
You monkey fan pussy.
Monkey fan fuck. Monkey fan pussy. That's right. Monkey fan pussy.
I actually had this written down because I couldn't.
But there is. I did write down monkey fan pussy, but I did find one redundant line.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck you, motherfucker.
Yeah. Okay, just for the record, if you've never done this, there is a Blade drinking game. Go back and watch the movie Blade and drink every time Steven Dorff drops an F-bomb. You will be drunk in the first 15 minutes of the movie, I swear to you.
Mm-hmm.
But no matter what your tolerance is. Yeah. But okay, so you have the cigarette-laced poison after he shoots.
No. Wait. Before that, we got to go back to John Goodman dancing on Milano's grave. Well, essentially dancing on his grave, but in reality, dancing on this place where he died.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really nice touch.
It was. And then you have the wrestling match between Goodman and Washington, and I'm thinking, Denzel has a short straw this time.
Yeah.
That is a really, really one-sided matchup.
But he manages to wrestle the gun down and shoots John Goodman in the stomach. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Azazel's all like, why? I was about to off myself anyway, so why shoot me? He goes, because I needed more time.
Yeah.
And, you know, this time I actually thought this through. And I'm wondering why he didn't actually get in the car and drive away and leave John Goodman there.
I have tried to figure that out a few times myself.
I think his worry was that, you know, Azazel might actually find a way to survive, or that he might find a way to die before he could get that far away.
Yeah.
But he kicked the gun away, didn't he?
I don't know. Well, even then, you know, he still could have found a way to do it. But, so then we've got, the cigarette. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. And
that is the most anticlimactic idea in a movie ever, but definitely in this one. I was not satisfied with this.
Oh, I loved it.
I thought it was intelligent. I thought it was a good plan. But as from a dramatic perspective, I thought it was horrible.
I thought it was actually, I thought it was a great idea and a really good twist, because you really don't know what the plan is until, you know, he tells him.
I kind of saw it coming when he started smoking. Like, from the moment he lit the cigarette, I pretty much knew what was going on.
Yeah.
I kind of saw it coming when Sam said, why did you buy a pack of cigarettes? I thought you quit smoking.
Yeah, and they make mentions of that, of him having quit smoking throughout this movie.
Yeah. But anyway, you have him, you know, they both die. And Azazel, you know, with the last breath, is trying to get away.
Yeah, trying to get the car keys that he threw out into the snow. And
yeah, and
then collapsing.
Really
in the middle
weird. And I was surprised that this, I didn't catch this. Mm-hmm. But Azazel being the narrator.
Yeah.
I did not catch it. Yeah, I couldn't believe I didn't catch it.
Every single voiceover that's done that Denzel Washington does in this movie
is Azazel.
Azazel. With the only exception, you think there's an exception, but there's not. And it's, he's, when he comes home one night and goes to call Greta, it's right after he shoots the school teacher. And what it is it's the phone call between him and Greta, but it's voiced over him walking in the door, and then you see him on the phone. But that's the only time that there's a voiceover that he does that's not, Azazel, and it's not actually a voiceover. It's just,
him talking on the phone.
You know, the audio being, you know, transposed over action video.
Huh. But still,
Whoop, am I still here?
Yep, you're still here.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And the really funny part, though, is I actually expected the cat. Because he did it earlier in the movie, too.
Yeah, and you see the cat the first time that John goes out to the cabin.
Yeah.
So, but, I love... And it's my favorite part of this movie is the, but you forgot something, didn't you?
Yeah.
At the beginning, I said I was going to tell you about the time I almost died.
See, I was thinking about that the whole time, that Hobbs was supposed to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I, once again, I'm kicking myself in the head for not catching the fact that Azazel was a narrator. Because I was thinking about it. It's like, he said he almost died. But if he doesn't die, then Azazel's going to possess him.
Mm-hmm. And the way that it's written is, you know.
Yeah.
And the first time that I watched this movie, everybody the first time through forgets that part. Forgets that he said, I was going to tell you about I almost died. Yeah, you're one of the very few who doesn't.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that because when I realized it was Azazel narrating, I was like, oh, okay, I see what's going to happen here. Because I remembered the cat and everything. I was like, okay, I know the rest of it.
I didn't remember the cat. So I was confused as to why did he almost die? And who the hell almost died?
Yeah.
And then it says, I'm Azazel. And it's like, oh, duh.
Yeah.
And then cut to credits, play Sympathy for the Devil, because that song is awesome.
Yeah.
Anyways. So, maybe I'll think of a different name for this, but I'm going to start ending our roundtables with this. Buff is good, no buff bad. Lisa, buff or no buff?
I will give it the Mindfuck Award.
Yeah, but is it
there?
No. You got to rate this good or bad, buff or no buff.
Yeah. The movie. Okay.
Good.
Buff. Good,
buff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Carl, buff or no buff?
I'm giving this a buffalicious.
A buffalicious. Okay.
Buffalicious.
Well, I'm not going to go that far, although I really enjoyed this movie. I know what's coming up in our list, and so I'm just going to give it a buff.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'll give it two buffs up. All right.
By the way, Rod, I have one thing to make a comment for the ladies to listen to this. Uh-huh. You're very limber if you can kick yourself in the head.
I actually can physically kick myself in the head, just for the record.
And I'm actually going to take this whole buffalicious thing a little farther. Uh-huh. I'm going to give this a buff the size of the porn stash.
Ooh.
Oh.
Now I'm thinking about porn stash buff, and I'm going to a John Holmes place. This is not.
Oh.
Okay. For that,
Harry.
Let's go on to buff quotes. Lisa, do you want to start us off with buff quotes?
Sure. Charlie said it best. You can stick this sandwich where this, or you can stick this job where the sandwich goes.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, he's talking about anal.
You know what you'd look like with this sandwich up your ass? Like a fat, stupid fuck with a sandwich up his ass.
I did love that line.
Oh, it's great. It's not my favorite line from this movie, though.
I could hardly pick a favorite line from this movie.
Well, there are so many great lines in this movie. You know, that somebody's playing with my dick and it ain't me. Or the, Lisa's, you stick the job where the sandwich goes. Or that's in the Bible. But
what,
no, my
gentleman, pederast.
Yeah. My absolute favorite line from this movie actually comes from your least favorite actress in this movie.
Oh, yeah?
And that is Greta's response to John. Everything's personal if you're a person.
It's a good point.
It is. It is.
Was that your buff quote tonight?
That is my buff quote tonight. Everything's personal if you're a person.
Okay. I also...
Wow, he got serious on us.
Well, yeah. I also went for a serious angle, which is really weird for me, because usually I go for whatever made me laugh the most. Mm-hmm. But
that would have been somebody's playing with my dick and it ain't me.
No, the one that made me laugh the most was what was it?
Ladies, gentlemen,
no.
Pederast.
No, actually, Reese pulls off some of the sickest shit on record, speaking language that's 2,000 years old, and you're worried because he's ambidextrous.
Yeah,
that was the one that made me laugh the most.
Too.
And in defense of John Goodman's line that somebody's playing with my dick and it ain't me, you got to remember, you got to look at John Goodman at this point in his life, and somebody would almost have to be playing with his dick that isn't him, because I don't know if the man can reach it around that gut.
No kidding. But of course, once again, amazing actor. But my buff quote for tonight is, "I believe what I see, and I'm still trying to get my mind around what I just saw."
Yep.
I loved how what's the word I'm looking for? Bizarre.
Yeah, and emotional.
Emotional and very deep that line was. I mean, it just really was a great line, very well delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Carl, you want to start us off with best buffed?
Oh, let's see. I am definitely going to give this movie the best mindfuck not starring Josh Hartnett award. Lisa actually asked me halfway through this movie, she's like, who's that actor that's in all the Mindfuck movies that you love? And I was like, Josh Hartnett? And she goes, yeah, do you think this movie would have been better with him in it? And I'm like, you know, it wouldn't. You think about it and you'd almost be tempted to say yes, but Denzel is so good at so many things that I can't even imagine what it would be like with Josh Hartnett in it.
Yeah, it is one, and I'm a huge Josh Hartnett fan, but this one just I don't think would have fit with anybody other than Denzel. That was just so well done.
Let's see, we've also got to give it the best porn stash outside of porn award.
Yeah, no.
And okay, about the scariest porn stash.
There you go.
The biggest 70s throwback that ever grew up someone's nose. Let's see.
And upper lip and lower lip and chin and cheeks.
The freakiest possession movie ever. I think this is actually freakier for me than anything like Exorcist type.
To me, actually, Roseanne Arquette in Stigmata, I thought was just really that scene where she comes in and her skin's all dried out and. Okay. To me, that was actually a little creepier. But go. I mean, it's your best.
Okay. How about this one? How about freakiest possession movie to not use an Exorcist trope?
There you go. Geez, you got a ton of best buffs tonight, don't you?
This is my favorite movie. This is, if not my favorite movie of all time, tied for it.
Fair enough. You are really into this movie.
Yeah.
You were into this movie just like James Gandolfini's nose was in porn stash.
Award notes half a page long or longer?
No, I'm pulling these off. I'm pulling these off the top of my head.
Fair enough.
It's probably also got to give it the award for best examination of the battle between good versus evil.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. I think I'll stop there.
Okay, that's probably a good idea. But
I could really give, you know, this movie awards all night. Yeah.
It was a great movie.
Yes, and there are two other people here, so.
Yeah, I'm not going to steal any from you guys.
Lisa?
You already did.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I also give it the best mindfuck award. It was a very good mindfuck. Again, not with a Josh Hartnett movie.
And just, you know, for the record to our listeners, if this whole Best Mindfuck Award gives you worry about the movie or about any other movies that we might suggest, I just have to repeat the immortal words of Tim Curry. Sometimes a mental mindfuck can be nice.
Yeah. And actually, I'll stipulate
on
this whole Best Mindfuck not starring Josh Hartnett, I actually have forgotten one. This movie actually is tied with another movie for that award, and that movie being Wild Things.
We will so cover that later, because that is on streaming.
Oh, yeah, that's on our list.
That's going on our list. Okay, keep going, Lise.
But I'm also giving it the best researched for theological discussions.
Yeah.
I can't call that religion.
Yeah.
It's just not in me. But I will discuss it as a theological.
I don't know that the research was actually all that great. I think that they picked a few verses
for its
out of the Bible.
Time. It was.
Well, actually, it kind of is, and I've got some trivia to back that up.
Okay.
John Hobbs, you know, Denzel Washington's character.
Uh-huh.
His name is actually drawn from two 17th century philosophers, Thomas Hobbes and John Locke.
Yeah, I knew
that. And Hobbes thought that men were generally evil and needed constraints of society to make them better. And Locke thought that men are thinking, rational creatures capable of peaceful coexistence. And those are the two themes that are really being explored here.
Well, fair enough. Okay. So actually, the research was pretty decently done.
Yeah.
Do you have any others, Lise?
No.
Okay. My best buff, I gave it the Who's Got the Demonic Button Award. Because this entire movie, I felt like we were playing Button, Who Has the Button?
Or Hot Potato,
yeah.
Yeah.
And also for its amazing twist ending, constant twist ending, I gave it the M. Night Eat Your Heart Out Award.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, M. Night, this is how you're supposed to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. M. Night Shyamalan wishes that he could write something this good.
No kidding.
Even Sixth Sense isn't this good.
No, and that was actually a pretty decent one.
And that's one of his best.
Yeah. That one or Unbreakable. But, anyway.
Yeah, Unbreakable is pretty good.
Unbreakable was awesome. But, anyway. Okay, where are you playing with your Willy? The segment where we ask each other questions to decide who was watching the movie and who was playing with their Willy. Lisa, do you want to start us off this time since I skipped you last week?
Or tried to skip
me? Or tried to skip you?
Yeah, just try and beat me this time.
There you go.
Okay.
No, you're not supposed to be playing with your Willy, Carl.
What was that?
Before Reese started writing letters on the victims, he wrote numbers. What were the numbers?
18 and 2.
I'm going to concede to Carl on this one.
That's because Carl's right.
Yeah, I figured he was. Okay.
When Lou gets possessed, he tells Hobbs to come here, and he uses a gesture. It's the same gesture somebody else uses in the film. What is it?
Waves a set of folders towards himself, doesn't he?
No, he's beckoning with either two or three fingers. I can't remember.
Carl is right. He holds his ring finger down and his thumb in and beckons over. Tries to beckon him over.
Yeah.
Hmm. That was
the same way that Reese did earlier.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Okay. You got any more over there?
Yes, but I'm only going to use them if there's a tie.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Carl.
Okay.
Stick with two, please.
Okay. What is Reese doing when Hobbs first walks into the prison?
Push-ups.
Lisa?
Peeing.
Yep.
Oh, he was
peeing. Well, there's actually some debate about that. He's either taking a piss or he's doing that because he does make reference a little bit later. Ooh, look, ladies, that's a piss stain. Or that's a urine stain. Oh, my, that's not urine.
Okay.
So he's either taking a piss or he's jacking off. Either answer.
I wasn't really sure, but I was going to go with the urine because normally people don't pull. I've not seen a man pull their pants down over their cheeks to jack off.
Okay, I'm not even going to go there. But I just have to say that this is the first time we've had a "Were you playing with your Willy?" question about someone actually playing with their Willy. I just have to point that out.
Okay, let's see. Mm-hmm. All right, and here's the one I'll go with. Okay, every time after the death of Reese, all of the bodies are found by somebody calling Hobbs and giving him the address, right?
Okay.
What is the street name of the location of the first body, the Russian?
Gold.
I'm going to concede again. I don't remember.
Actually, you didn't. Lisa didn't get that one right. It was South Cinder.
South Cinder.
Yep. Okay.
Interesting name. That definitely seems like it has some symbolism there.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I didn't catch the second one.
I believe the word you're looking for is symbolism. Symbolism.
I to do that movie.
We have it on our list already.
I know.
So I can't wait. That's going to be so much fun.
I don't even remember when we're doing it, but I know.
I'll look it up after the show. Okay. My turn to ask questions. There was only one of the news vans in the second scene that showed the actual channel on it. It was while the cops were turning down the street. What was that channel?
Channel 8.
Lisa?
I'm conceding. I don't know.
Wrong. Channel 4.
Ah.
Okay. What number was written in chalk or white paint? I couldn't tell for sure. On the column just before Hobbs chased the shadow, quote unquote, up the stairs to the monorail.
You said number?
Yeah, it was a number written on the column.
Five.
I'm going to go with 13 because I have no idea.
Wow.
That's why I went with 5.
5 was wrong. Really weird that you said that because the number is actually 31.
Ah.
You were really close. Obviously, you saw it and turned it around in your subconscious. So it looks like Carl's our winner.
Carl won.
Yeah. And by the way, for the record, Boondock Saints, 8 weeks from today.
8 weeks.
Is when we're recording it. So it'll post 8 weeks from the one this, from when this one posts.
From when our listeners are listening right now.
Yep. Hello, future people.
Hello.
Sorry.
This is from the future.
Okay. Sorry. The hello, future people is a meme I take from, majorspoilers.com and, Critical Hit. Cause they always talk about people listening to their show like months after it comes out.
Fair enough. I actually had another question. I'm just kind of curious to see if y'all can get it. It's not for any points. But I did have, what was written on the top of the milk carton every time that Azazel was eating his cornflakes.
Homogenized?
Yep. I was curious.
Yeah. That's what it was.
Well, here's a curiosity.
It was blue 2%, 1-quart milk containers.
Wow.
Here's a curiosity question. What was the basketball score?
Oh. Why didn't you use that one?
I don't know.
I don't either. God.
Nope.
1917.
Oh.
Wow. Okay, well.
is why you have... Oh, what is the word at the bottom of the screen?
Subtitles.
That's it!
Well, I had subtitles on it. I don't remember them actually saying that.
Yeah, I don't... I didn't.
They
ever...
did. I caught barely
they
caught
probably
it.
Did. Just don't remember it. Okay, so after that, we definitely need a mental debuff. Lisa, would you like to start us off?
Well, other than being a really good mind fuck and a really good theological discussion for, you know, whoever wants to do that sometime, I liked it. I really enjoyed it. And no, I wouldn't mind watching it again. Not tonight.
Carl.
Fallen, the twistiest, most freakiest movie I think Denzel's ever been in. And holy God, this movie is, if this movie's not in your top 10 list, it definitely needs to be.
Now I have to argue a point. The freakiest, most twistiest movie Denzel's ever been in was Meg Ryan.
That's not a movie. That's a person.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm positive.
I'm
almost positive that Meg Ryan is in fact a person.
About 70% sure.
Yeah, who Tom Hanks constantly is falling in love with. So.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Keep going.
No, that was it.
Oh, that was it. Okay.
Yep.
And with that, we move into our segment called Rod's Rants.
Oh, boy.
My favorite.
Are you
segment.
Singing again?
A little.
Oh, cool.
Just so you know. No.
It's on my side.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. All right. Okay. Look, M. Night Shyamalan, this is how you do a twist ending. The only true issue I have with this is it was made in the early days of the internet and was not accurate with accepted demonological theory. I'm just fucking with you. This movie was great and Denzel was awesome. But can we please take the camera off of him once in a while? Seriously, Denzel, you're good, but your ego is absorbing the story. Also, in reality of the situation were to happen, when the black dude knew he was headed out to die, he would be all over that white chick, making all kinds of nasty poses. So I want to finish this with saying thank you, Gregory Hoblit. Thank you, all-star cast and crew. And pleased to meet you. Denzel is my name. Okay.
And I gotta add to the end of that, Rod, that,
okay.
A great big huge thank you once again to Nicholas Kazan for writing this story.
Yes, it was an amazing story. And I really want to see this in novelization. Is it?
Seems
like the kind of thing that would be.
I'm not sure if they did a novelization of this movie or not. I know that the novel, if it is, then it's a novelization of the movie.
Okay.
Because there wasn't a book that this was based on.
Okay, well, thank you, listeners. Yes?
I have to add one thing.
Good catch.
There is a reason that the camera doesn't go off of Denzel. Time is always on his side.
Oh, let's not start again. But, I don't know.
I didn't sing it. You did.
I know. I just think that with Denzel, it's all of his movies are like that. They're very focused on him. And with an all-star cast like this one had, it was pushing it a little to me. But we'll discuss this in another day. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. Make sure to listen next week to Hard Target in the Buff. Commence tiny penis jokes. Good night, folks, and remember to keep watching those movies in the buff. It's just better that way.
Good night.
Good night.
Hello, Buffers. It's your favorite host. I'm taking a second to let you know you can find us on Facebook and Google+, and have some absolutely naughty conversations with your other Buffers. And as always, if you need to talk or flirt with our team of debauchery, you can email us at inthebufffilms@gmail.com. That's 3 F's. Trust me, we love to talk to our fans, especially the good-looking ones. Movies in the Buff was recorded with Creative Commons, Attribution Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 U.S. License.